It's common knowledge that climate change is a cause that needs our attention. Soaring temperatures, increasingly destructive storms, and rising sea levels are demanding it. But most of the time, we're not really able to witness firsthand the changes that need to take place. Options are out there, but the attention we're giving them doesn't always match the urgencies. So what do? Well, could making sustainability a source of entertainment help this cause? We might not love the idea of sitting in a classroom to learn about scientific inner workings of a hydrogen fuel cell, but we'd definitely be interested in seeing a sustainably powered flax fiber shell race car rip through the Sahara Desert, right? Or even to see this across some of the most remote places in the world that are being impacted by climate change. Better yet, let's take it a step further and put an equal number of men and women on every team. Though this might sound like a plot of a dystopian near future Mad Max film, the scenario actually is a scene straight out of the world of Extreme E racing. Extreme E aims to change the face of the industry while accomplishing some pretty major environmental goals. Created with the mission of promoting sustainability, it's the first racing series of its kind that proves car racing can be fueled entirely by renewable resources. And Extreme E sees the need for its message and mission as more relevant now than ever. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernardin, VP Strategic Automotive Initiatives at Siemens Digital Industry Software. And this episode, we have the perfect guest that has experience in entertainment, in racing, and a strong drive for addressing issues related to climate change and diversity to discuss what it's like from the driver's seat of the sustainability-focused Extreme E Racing Series. We're going to look at the future of transportation, but with an emphasis on sustainability and gender diversity. We're so lucky to have with us Katie Munnings. She is a driver in the Extreme E Racing Series, sharing equal driving duties with her teammate, Timmy Hansen. And not only that, but Katie also had her own TV show. All of this by the age of 23, which is utterly amazing. Katie, thank you so much for joining us on the Future Car Podcast.
Oh, thank you for the lovely introduction as well. It's great to be chatting to you.
Well, listen, I want to get into your career and how you have accomplished so much by the age of 23 that most people can't accomplish in their entire lives. But I'd like to start off for our listeners, if maybe you could explain a little bit about Extreme E. Because when people think about racing, they might think of Formula One, they might think about NASCAR, cars that go around on a track. Then, of course, there's rally, which races on dirt against time. But rarely, if ever, do you think about racing and sustainability and gender diversity all at the same time. Tell us, what is Extreme E? What are its goals? What's it all about?
Yeah, exactly. As you kind of hit the nail on the head when you said you don't think of sustainability and racing at the same time. When you look at in the history books, it's been very male-dominated, exhaust fumes, polluting, and it hasn't been very sustainable at all when you think about it. So when I first heard about Extreme E, I didn't believe it, to be honest with you. I didn't believe that it was a real kind of idea for a championship. I remember my first meeting with Extreme E. They said, we're going to have a massive ship, which is going to be our floating paddock, and it's going to sail around the world. Then we're going to race in the most extreme areas that we can find. And then we're going to be doing a lot of scientific research. So we're going to be planting trees in the Amazon, and we're going to be racing around the glaciers in Greenland. And I remember hearing it and thinking, this is absolutely insane. It sounds like a movie. It sounds like something from a James Bond film. It doesn't sound like it's, it just hasn't been done before. Especially when they were describing some of the most remote parts of the world that we were going to be able to visit. I was skeptical at first because obviously I didn't think it would happen. And then I signed up for the championship as I started to learn more about it and believe in it. And now having experienced it firsthand, it is kind of polar opposite to what I've known motorsport as in the past. So it's basically a championship that is raising awareness for the effects of climate change. And each basically, it's called an X-Prix. Each race is called an X-Prix. And each has got an environmental message. So next week, we're off to the Arctic Expiry. And the environmental message there is around, obviously, the sea levels and the effects that climate change is having on that side and the melting of the ice caps up in Greenland. And when we were in Senegal, we were looking a lot at planting mangroves, which apparently are one of the best kind of trees you can plant for the environment, for biodiversity in soil, in fish, and also carbon capture. And so there's been so much. I'm not a scientist at all, so you can't quote me on any of it. But
planting mangroves, that's interesting. Yeah. You never, this is the first time I've ever heard racing associated with mangroves at all, much less planting them.
Yeah, do you know, it was funny. We all arrived. It wasn't just turn up and have a photo, which is normally the case when a championship or an organization does some environmental work. You kind of turn up for a photo and then everyone goes home and, you know, it's posted on social media. This was literally the complete opposite. We were on a 6-hour coach trip to this town in Senegal, and we got onto these tiny little boats. We sailed up the river for about an hour. We got out and we did some planting, and there we were working with local communities that are actually employed for the next few years to plant mangroves, sponsored by Extreme E. So they're planting, I think, 1 million trees. And so we helped them just do just a few of those. And then the tide had gone out by the time we came back. So we went to our boats and we ended up, all of us, barefoot. These are all the drivers that are going to be racing, pushing the boats through this like sand and mud. In this riverbed.
A lot of mud
in
the middle, through your toes.
Honestly, you should have a look on the internet at some of the videos. It was so funny seeing us all out of the boat pushing it. And this is like the day before we went racing. And we were just with the local people having such an exciting and adventurous day. Mangroves apparently are the tree to be planting to have the best effect on the environment, which I didn't know before Extreme E. So I'm learning a lot as we go.
So you're racing cars as part of the event, but it sounds like you do these things like planting mangrove. And the idea is to use the racing event to draw attention to the fact that, hey, if you plant mangrove trees, that's good for the climate. It's good for the atmosphere. It's going to eat up CO2.
Yeah, so I think Extreme E in the early days of designing the championship, they did some research into what the most watched programs have been on TV in history. And apparently it's always been sports matches. So they were aware of the audience that sport can have if you deliver a really good sporting format, and in our case, really good racing. And they said, actually, let's combine the two things, because we've got some really high profile drivers. We've got like Carlos Sainz, Sebastian Loeb from the rally side. And then we've got Nico Rosberg and Hamilton and, you know, Andretti and Chip Ganassi, lots of different teams that have got big followings in their own right. And the idea was to use that platform that we have collectively as a sport, and especially nowadays through social media. And there's been a lot of emphasis on us as drivers as sharing the knowledge that we've been learning from these scientists. So when we went to Saudi Arabia, it was the first race of the year, our first introductions into what Extreme was, and we all arrived, flew in, went straight to the ship. And then I think we had 3 days of like 2-hour lectures in the evening, and like we were going off with the scientists and doing workshops on the beaches during the day. And it was like really hardcore learning about the environmental issues that they were facing there. And I was really surprised at the depth that they were kind of pushing us into. But it was, you know, it's really cool, because then obviously we're able to put it into our terms and then relay that to our following.
So Nico is a Formula One, former Formula One champion. Is he any good at planting trees? Are you a better tree planter?
Do you know, it has been really fun, and it's been funny watching everyone kind of roll up their sleeves and get involved with the championship. We were talking about it in Saudi Arabia, because normally, you know, you get used to, for example, a Formula One or even Rallycross. I was speaking to my teammate, he's from Rallycross, and they were saying every year you end up going to the same nice hotels, the same track, you fly to the same airport, and you know exactly what you're getting. And it's very kind of clinical, and it's almost like being at home everywhere. And then we went to Saudi Arabia, and obviously we're going into the middle of the desert. There's no kind of nice hotels or anything like that. So we were literally staying, everyone was staying in like tiny apartments in different parts of the town, which, I mean, ours had like a mosque next to it. And so the call to prayer was at like 4:45 a.m. every day. You have to completely adapt to the environment that you're in. I was joking that I didn't have a towel for the shower the whole week that I was there. So I was just using one of my old t-shirts. Like, it was really, you have to be up for the adventure of it. But I think, you know, that is part of what we're doing, isn't it? You can't expect everywhere to be what you know when you're traveling to those remote locations.
Well, I think too, people can experience your adventure by watching the races and the events as they come off. So there's only been a couple of races so far. The third one, I believe, is the one that's going to be up here in Greenland. So you've been to Senegal, you've been to Saudi in the desert. Do you feel it's starting to have an impact? Are you getting any feedback that this is a good vehicle by which to bring climate change and the impact of things like planting trees out to a general audience?
I think so. I think the viewing figures, if we look at that from the racing, which obviously in the programs, they're like 2 hour long programs that have got a lot from the scientists involved as well. And the viewing figures have been massive. My kind of agent, I was having a conversation with them the other day, and they'd done a lot of analysis in comparison to other racing series and sports championships. And they were saying that they were really impressed with it. That's kind of from the UK side. I know that there's lots of different things going on all over the world as well. So I think that's been exciting. And I think also that they're running a league for basically the environmental side, which is called Count Us In. And you can support your favorite team by pledging to, for example, reduce the amount that you use your car or cycle more, or even change your energy supplier for your house to renewable energy, or buy an electric car, or eat less meat. All of these things, it doesn't have to be massive steps. But when you pledge that you do it, you can put your points and you can say, I've done this and I'm allocating my points to Team Andretti United.
How are you doing in the environmental point standings?
I think we're doing okay. Yeah, I haven't looked at it for a few weeks now. We were doing okay before. I need to pick up my pledges a bit as well.
Have you pledged anything at all yet?
Yeah, I have.
What have your pledges been so far?
So small steps have been the ones that, because I was actually having this conversation with Timmy yesterday. He FaceTimed me because we hadn't spoken for a while between the races. So we were having a bit of a catch up. And he was saying that we were talking about the count.
This is your co-driver you're talking about?
So each team has got a male and a female driver. I didn't explain that actually when you asked me what Extreme E was, but Extreme E is basically the best thing about it from the diversity side, I guess, is that each team has to have a male driver and a female. And normally you can see, you know, females dotted around motorsport, but actually the overall team result now is both of our laps combined. So there's no sort of second driver or the male having more testing. There's emphasis on both drivers. So obviously that's amazing for providing more professional seats for females at the top. So that's exciting. So that's what Timmy is. So he's the male driver in the team and I'm the female driver. So we're never together in the car. He'll do a lap and we have a quick driver change, like, you know, when you say in Le Mans, for example, and then I'll do a lap, and then whichever team crosses the finish line first is the winner. So that's our role together. So he's coming from Rallycross, and we were speaking yesterday, and we were talking about the Count Us In campaign, and he was saying that when he first thought about doing better things for the environment and changing his lifestyle a bit, he was quite put off by it because he thought that you know you've got to do all or nothing. So you have to turn completely vegan, your house has got to be, you know, completely
solar
converted.
Panels,
yeah, exactly. And he said he never really realized that small steps can have an impact. So when you look on the Count Us In, there's really small stuff like, I'm going to eat less meat, or I'm going to have less dairy this week, or I'm not going to use plastic water bottles for July. You don't have to completely change your life. So I think that's the biggest thing, is like not to get overwhelmed by it. So I haven't done any of the big ones yet.
Well, all race drivers are very competitive. So I'm sure you must be competitive on the points are stacking up on the environmental side.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm ticking off, I'm slowly ticking off all of the ones that are probably, let's say, easier to achieve.
What specifically have you done? What are you proud of on your environmental points?
Definitely driving less.
You're driving less. Oh, my goodness.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm taking my bike to the shops and stuff like that when I can. So, yeah, I mean, not in the competitive side. I always want to be driving more.
And that's electric, so that's actually not so bad.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and that's run off hydrogen fuel cell as well, so that's quite cool that we're using the latest technology from that side. Collectively, as a family, we've found it like an organic farm shop. So if I eat meat, it's only really good quality and we know where it's sourced and it's local. Yeah, I'm eating less of that, less dairy, less plastic in general, all the things that are quite easy to do. And I think then obviously in the future, it'll be looking into electric cars and what you can do from your energy sources and your home and that sort of thing as well.
So for the people that watch and will participate by saying, I did this or I did that, is there a competition on that by who in the audience has done the most? How does that work? Because it seems like a great way to feel like you're doing something yourself.
I think it's really cool. And actually, it's something that Extreme E have done across the board. So not just with the Count Us In, obviously, you can pledge your points for your favorite team and then the teams get, there's actually a trophy for it at the end of the year. And I think if you win that, you get to go to the FIA prize giving, which is like the big motorsport prize giving with Formula One and all the rest of it. But they're actually doing it in the race as well. So I don't know if you've heard about this boost that you can get. So it's called fan vote. So the fans can vote for their favorite team. And then their vote actually determines the start grid for the final race at the weekend. So they have a big influence. They did it with Formula E. They had this fan boost thing where they could literally have more power in the car. But with Extreme E, they've done it. They're deciding the start grid for the final.
Is it a big boost? Do you get a lot more power, or is it like 1%?
I don't know what it is. No, I think it's quite, I think it is quite a lot in Formula E because they have to do kind of, they drive off of the racing line to get it. And then I think that they get it for one lap. So I think it is enough to make it worthwhile.
You do that in Extreme E as well?
We don't get the power boost, but we get the votes, basically. Whoever has the biggest pool of votes at the end of the weekend before the final on Sunday gets to choose pole for the race. And so then obviously it goes to second and third. And if you haven't qualified for the final, you get to gift your votes to another team. So in the first race, I think we had Jenson Button's team gifted his votes to us. And so did Carlos Sainz. They gifted their votes from us as well. So yeah, you have to make sure you're friends with everyone in the paddock as well.
Oh, I was going to say, what do you do to get more votes? It sounds very important if it's going to get you on the poll.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of posting on social media and my mum shares it a lot. So that's nice.
You need a PR company to get you at P1 at first position.
Yeah, it's going to get more competitive as the year goes on, I think.
Well, let's talk about some of these locations, which are so unlike other type of racing events. Most people think when you race, you're racing on a track, right? So IndyCars, Formula One, NASCAR. And then you have rally. In the United States, people aren't quite as familiar with rally, but rally is on against time and is off-road. But here, all those events have spectators. So there's really, in Extreme E, it's not about the spectators. And then you're going to these extreme locations without spectators and having races. Tell us a little bit about the locations, and from deserts to beaches to the Arctic. Tell us about those and how do you get there and move around? I mean, it can't be easy to go to the Arctic Circle. I don't think Southwest flies there direct. I'm sure they don't from Boston.
You know, that has been one of the biggest challenges is the logistics of it. And I think even, you know, with the pandemic and travel restrictions, it's been made so much more complicated. It's almost an achievement just to make it to the race in itself, you know, with immigration and everything. And I've been hearing of some mechanics in the different race championships that my team are involved in. Some haven't been let in, some have, and they've got the same documents. You know, it's a crazy world out there at the minute, I think. Then, of course, when you're trying to reach the most remote areas of the world, it is not made easier. In Greenland, for example, we've been told that we're all sleeping on the boat, so we're all bunking up, so the drivers are sharing basically bunk beds in these cabins on the ship.
So everything is on the ship, all the drivers, all the equipment, all the cars in one ship.
Yeah, it's a massive, so it used to be like in a cargo ship, and now it's been converted. So there's actually a 50-person crew that lives on it and sails around the world all the time for the racing. And then we move in, and it's got capacity for drivers to stay on there as well. And then we have our catering there. So I think we're getting tenders at like 5 a.m. from the boat, that obviously that's at sea, and we come across into the land, and then we're going into off-road vehicles because there's no roads to where we're racing. So we're getting into like off-road trucks that are going to transport us all through whatever. To be honest, I have no idea what even the land looks like there. So we're basically venturing inland for about 2 hours. Then we get to where they've made the race location. So I haven't seen the tracks. We're not allowed to see the tracks before we go. So from what I've been told by the organizers is that it's quite picturesque, quite flat, but it's an area that used to be ice, which has obviously melted due to climate change.
But you're racing on dirt then?
Yeah, so we're racing on like this kind of gravel rock, and I think some black ice, and there's some rivers that are obviously flowing from where the ice is melting. So I think we're in and out of those with the ice in the background, obviously, is the message of the race. So yeah, each has been very different. When we were in Saudi Arabia, our trucks couldn't actually get over the sand dunes. They were all getting stuck for the track walk. So
did you have camels pull you out?
Yes, we were literally, and it's like a 10-kilometer track. It doesn't sound that far, but we had like an hour I think it was about an hour and a half to see the whole track. And so me and Timmy actually ended, and we're running up sand dunes, the steep, to see what's over the top, because the next day we're arriving with a car
that sounds
100
exhausting.
Miles an hour. It was. And so we were absolutely shattered, and we'd be running up this in deep sand, and it was like 40 degree heat in the middle of the desert in the middle of the day. And then I've got my GoPro trying to film it, trying to see where the truck's going to go.
That sounds crazy. Let's run up this sand dune to figure out what's on the other side to see if we're going in the right direction.
I know. It was mad. And then in Senegal, we all had the same, because some people in Saudi, some people's trucks were able to get over the sand dunes. So we were like, oh, that's an advantage.
Well, it sounds like the exact opposite of going to Monaco or to Indianapolis for the 500.
Definitely. It is completely different. And I know that when we're in Greenland, because obviously it's so remote, we can't actually get any vehicles there to do the recce. So we're all walking the track walk. But I've heard it's a bit flatter and it's on gravel. So that sounds easier.
So you have the desert in Saudi, you have Senegal beach, you have Greenland racing. Is there anything else?
It was meant to be, there was meant to be one in the Amazon. So that was the Amazon X-Prix, which would have been racing on, like, obviously the deforested area. So some tree stumps and things like that. And then the legacy work there would be to put a lot of money into the community, replant trees. And then we were meant to be having one on Patagonia on the glacier as well. But because of COVID, we haven't been able to reach South America this year. So instead, we're going to Sardinia. And that one was announced a couple of weeks ago. That will be our island X-Prix. So I don't know.
Sardinia is not a bad backup, I'd have
to
say.
No, I know. And I was thinking I could probably stay there a week after the race as well if I had to. So
So you're going to be in Greenland, I think, is it the 26th through 28th? Is that the right? Did I get the dates correct?
That's it. Yeah. So it's next week now.
Okay. So here we are about 2 weeks out. Explain the logistics here. For instance, when do you pack your bag? When do you hop on the first flight in the boat? How do you get from where you are now with all your preparation and you arrive there, and I imagine there's must be a crew there now setting things up. What does it take to set up a race in the Arctic Circle?
I have no idea how they're doing it, to be honest with you. I really don't. When we got to Senegal, it was cool because they were employing a lot of local people.
It was already when you got there.
Yeah, exactly. You just turn off a drive. No, but having spoken to the organizers, they're there for weeks in advance. They've got two drivers who create the course and set the course up ahead of time. So I think they're out there. I think they flew out today, actually, I saw on Instagram. I think we're flying next week, but it changes with every race. Obviously, you know, sometimes we have to quarantine and we've got lots of different other rules that we have to follow at the minute. But yeah, we normally have a legacy day on the Tuesday and the Wednesday where we go and for example, I think we're taking a trip up to the ice cap this time. So we're kind of doing a part of the hike that they have there. And we're seeing, I think we're putting a lot of infrastructure in. They haven't got toilets and stuff like that there for the explorers. So I think we're putting in toilets so there's less litter up on that area because apparently it gets quite bad because obviously there's just not facilities and people go there quite a lot from the adventuring side. So we're doing that on the Wednesday, and then I think we go to the track on the Thursday, and then we have free practice on Friday, and then we go into qualifyings on Saturday, and then the final on the Sunday.
Are you taking the boat to Greenland?
So the boat's already there.
Oh, okay, so you'll fly in then.
Yeah, so we can't travel with the boat because just the boat takes so long to get there. Obviously, it's a massive ship and it's going from one side of the world to the other. So it's been there for a couple of weeks, I think. Because everything is self-contained. So the hospitality units, everything from like our team setups and all of our computers, helmets, cars, everything like that is on the boat. So it takes a while to offload that and then obviously ship it inland. So we're having a championship flight. So we're all getting together to then fly everyone from one airport straight into where we're going in Greenland. Because I think it's quite complicated to reach where we're going. But then obviously it's massively limited on, we've only got one plane going. So it's obviously massively limited on actually how many people can go. Because the last thing we want to be doing is flying 10 planes in when we're running an environmental championship, if you know what I mean. So I think that that's why there's a limit. I think there's 8 people per team, which is not a lot when you think of what they have in Formula One and IndyCar. And that's including team principals and marketing and media and communications. And then obviously the mechanics and engineers. So it's really capped and really stripped down. So everybody's got to have 2 jobs, really. But it's part of the excitement of it.
Well, maybe when the electric plane is more viable, then you'll be able to have more planes going up there. It'll be a little cleaner.
Exactly. It's only a matter of time, isn't it?
Let's take a step back and talk a little bit about how you got to where you are now. And maybe go way back to when you were a little girl. And how did you first get involved in wanting to race around? What was your inspiration? How did it all come about? I know your father was involved in rally. How did it all start?
When I grew up, my dad, he was an instructor for rally at Brands Hatch and Oxford Rally Schools. Before that, he had been a rally driver himself, but he never really had budget to do it properly. So he was racing over in Belgium and he was really quick. Motorsport is quite inaccessible from that side. You know, it's massively expensive to get involved in. And
I think you've experienced the same throughout your career as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's not the easiest one, let's say that. So he has a big talent and he still kind of works alongside me and is always coaching me. If I listen, that's another matter. There's lots of arguments that happen, but I think that's what happens when you work with your family, isn't it?
So you grew up on a farm and your dad created a course for you.
Well, I actually started grass auto testing when I was about 14, and that's just in a normal car. So it's like a slalom. So handbrake turns, reverse flicks, the sort of things that you see in stunt movies, really. That's what I was learning with my sister. So we started doing that at the local motorsport club every Wednesday after school. It was on the local airfield. So I did that until I was about 17. And then I had the opportunity to go to a test with Peugeot and they were running part of the European Rally Championship. But it was called the Peugeot Rally Academy. It was about bringing young drivers up. And so I went and I actually, it was massively in at the deep end because I was sat in a rally car, which was an R2, which is like world championship class for the juniors, but it's very competitive left-hand drive. I was only 17, so I'd only just passed my driving test and I hadn't driven left-hand drive, hadn't driven in Europe.
Can't even rent a car.
No, I can't. I still can't. Can you believe that? I have to take my dad away now if I go on
my
own.
Well, I mean, you're a rally driver. They're probably thinking, oh, no way, we're letting her rent a car. Who knows how it'll come back?
Yeah, I can't for different reasons now.
Well, you know, on your wiki page, there's a couple of interesting facts that I want to ask you about. One of the things that they brag about, have you read your wiki page? Have you looked at it recently?
It annoyed me, you know, a few years ago. I tried to change some of the facts because they weren't true.
And it came up and it said,
yeah, it said you're an invalid source. I was like, how can
technology run amok?
I know. It said it has to be like on the news for or something for it to be counted as a reliable source.
Well, you did have a TV show. Maybe you can become a newscaster on the side or something
to fix that.
But one of the things that they mentioned was they proudly spoke about how by the age of 13, you have mastered the handbrake turn. Now, I know most of our listeners probably say, handbrake turn? What in the world is that? Why do I even care? The handbrake turn is an important thing to master when you're racing on dirt or wet grass. I guess, are you the youngest ever to master? What is the handbrake turn and how did you master it at such a young age?
I think my dad would say that I still haven't mastered it, to be honest with you. so a handbrake,
he's always pushing you to greater heights.
I know. Ruthless. No, a handbrake turn is basically when you're driving in one direction and then you kind of lift off the gas. You can't press the brake at the same time because then you just have horrible understeer, which basically means you can't turn the car. But you lift off the gas and turn the steering wheel and then literally pull the handbrake. You see it in movies all the time when the baddies do 180s and then you end up facing the other way and you can drive off. So that's a handbrake turn.
Do you ever do it for fun? Like when you're driving to the grocery store or, you know, around the neighborhood?
Try not to on the road. I'm lucky where we live. We've still got some fields and stuff. So sometimes when I'm parking my car or whatever, I will. Just because it's convenient, it's easier. I remember when I was younger, I used to have my friends over and dad bought like a couple of old banger cars that were literally from the salvage site. And we used to come home from school and they'd come on a sleepover and we'd just go and drive around the fields and they would learn how to handbrake turn. And then when they went to their driving lessons when they were 17, they were saying like, oh, I feel comfortable handbrake turning, but I can't parallel park. And I think they sometimes scared their driving instructors by saying, like, they say, oh, what experience do you have in a car? And they say, well, I can do this and I can do this. And I think their instructors would be like, don't do any of that, please.
Well, and in fact, I'd like to tell our listeners that don't go off and try handbrake turns now, that Katie is a professional driver and has taken her years to master this. So keep that in mind. Now, there was another very interesting fact on your wiki page. I have to ask you about this, which says, and I'm just going to quote it directly. It says, was talent spotted as a dancer? Do you know anything about this? First, talent spotted, which means you must have a great talent as a dancer. Is this true? Or you still tell us about what that means?
I was really competitive when I was younger. So I started with athletics and I wanted to be, well, I was watching, it was around 2012 when the London Olympics were on and Jessica Ennis was my hero and she was doing the heptathlon. And so I was doing the pentathlon and I was training really seriously as that. And I absolutely wanted to be in athletics, but I did a bit of everything. And yeah, that is true.
Did you win any prizes or any competitions?
I didn't do competitions, not that kind. No, it was more just like, I don't know how you spin it, like musical theatre schools in England, I guess. So that was what I was going into. So I used to get every Saturday and then I stopped doing that when I started rallying, I think, because I literally just ran out of time to do everything. At the school, I was like studying. I wanted to be a vet. And then on Saturday, I wanted to be a dancer. And in the evenings during the week, I was still doing my athletics. And I think my parents just got fed up with running me all over the place.
Pick something. Yeah. You can't keep going like this. Earlier, or actually it was last year, I had Sarah Spanglo on podcast, and she's the CEO of this company that makes these little teeny miniature satellites. Swarm is the name of the company. And when she was young, she's CEO now, but when she was young, she wanted to be a ballerina. And now she ended up, and just within the last few weeks here, this summer, they were acquired by SpaceX. So Elon Musk bought their company. So I think that's a sign. Today, I want to be a dancer. Tomorrow, CEO, championship rally driver. You never know where your career is going to take you.
Absolutely.
Your inspiration, I've read, is Michel Mouton. I've worked a little bit with her on a project that I mentioned that we did with Rally to try and use sensors and autonomous technology to make rally safety. And that's a great passion of hers. But she was a great champion in the 80s. in Raleigh. So has she been a great inspiration for you over the years?
She's really cool. I think what she did in those cars was awesome. And yeah, I've got massive respect for her, the way that she drove, the way that she handled herself as well. I think she was the only female at the top at that time. So it was cool that she put herself there and handled it well. Yeah, I've worked with her before because she's working with the FIA now on the safety side. So, for example, when I did Rally Rome, she was the opening car for the rally. So she was checking that all the spectators were standing in the right areas. And so she was kind of shouting at everyone to move out the way. She's quite fiery. So, yeah, she's an awesome woman. I've got a lot of respect for her.
I was sitting in the backseat of a rally car on the shakedown run where she would go around to find all those crazy people that were out in the middle of the road. And she did the exact same thing. She told the driver to stop. She would yell at them. And then she turned to me and she said, Ed, see these people? I yell at them. They move. But when we come back in 10 minutes, they'll be there again. Your technology has to try and fix that. Now you drive for the Andretti team. I grew up in Indianapolis. And when I was growing up, Mario Andretti was my, you know, racing hero. He must give you advice, I would imagine, racing advice. And I'm sure Michelle probably gives you some advice, too, when it comes from a rally standpoint. How do you compare the advice that Mario gives you versus Michelle? Do you get advice from both?
To be honest, no, not so much. So Mario hasn't been to one of our races yet. So I met him briefly at Goodwood Festival of Speed, which was cool to bump into him there. But I think he's quite focused on the IndyCar side, obviously with travel restrictions this championship. So we've only been going for a couple of races, and I think it's been difficult to get out of America and back in. I know that Michael definitely wants to come over to one of the races as well. So I'm sure we'll see more of that in the future. We had Zach Brown in Saudi with us, which was really cool. Obviously, he's the boss of the McLaren Formula One team as well. So to have him there and to be hearing from him, he owns the United, or co-owns the United Autosports side of our race team. So it's a joint team. So the Andretti side and the United Autosports side. So yeah, it was cool. It was cool to have him there. He's a really kind of relaxed guy. Yeah, no expectations or you know, no sit-down kind of high-pressured chats. It was more a case of everyone just feeling their way into the championship and getting comfortable with it. And yeah, I think it's really nice to have that energy so that you don't feel too much pressure going into the first races, that you feel like you've got room to explore it a bit. So yeah, he was a cool guy to have at the race.
Well, Mario has NASCAR, IndyCar, Formula One, but I don't think he's done anything with rally. Maybe when he does come to an Extreme E event, you could get him in the car and teach him how to do the handbrake turn.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure he could do a handbrake turn. Don't think I need to teach him.
Let's talk a little bit about your TV show, Katie's Amazing Machines. And I am absolutely sure that you are the first person that's ever been on this podcast that's driven a monster truck, an excavator, a train, a submarine, a jet, a police car. And I believe that you would learn how to drive these different machines like the morning of the show or soon before. And then you'd get in them and you would explain how all these different machines work. Tell us a little bit about your show, Katie's Amazing Machines, and how you got involved in it.
So it was like Top Gear for children, I guess is the best way to explain it. And so it wasn't just cars. So it would basically be a show where I test any machine. So from, like, as you say, like a combine harvester in the fields with the farmers. And then I'd be in a jet plane or a helicopter. I did a snowplow in the Alps as well.
Would you drive it yourself?
Oh, yeah, I had to. And because it was BBC, that's like the British Broadcasting House, they have rules where you can't, nothing can be untrue, if you know what I mean. It's quite a factual show. So I couldn't say I'm driving.
Just like American media.
So I basically couldn't say that I was driving and then have a stunt driver do the shot. So I would have to do it, which I was completely fine with. Obviously, it was cool to experience. And so it would be manic filming because I was competing in the European Championship at the same time. So it would literally be two machines every day we'd have to film to fit it around the race schedule. So I'd be learning how to fly a helicopter in the morning, filming that, driving 2 hours, learning how to do a submarine in the afternoon and filming that. And yeah, it was absolutely manic, but it was really good memories. I did an interview on the BBC Breakfast Show, which is like a news channel in the UK, after I won the ladies championship in the European Championship. And I think just one of the producers from Kids TV watched the interview and said, oh, it'd be really cool to have a female in this kind of role where she's shown to drive and to master typically male-dominated kind of industries where driving a machine or a tractor is often thought to be kind of a male role.
Yeah, a lot of variety in those machines.
Yeah, right?
Police
cool.
Cars, harvesters. Let's take, for example, the jet. So you actually flew the jet, fighter plane. It's actually a fighter plane, I believe. And for the show. Now, you didn't take off and land, but you flew it in the air, I would imagine. How long does it take to learn to fly a jet for that TV show you did?
Not long at all. It was always down to the filming schedule. So there'd be times when I said, look, I think I'm actually going to need a bit longer on this just to make it safe, you know? I think when you're filming something like that, it's really easy to think, okay, well, we've got to be here at then because we've booked that machine for there and we've got this person meeting us there and you've got your briefing for that. But sometimes you're actually like, well, hang on, because this is something that takes years to master and I'm having to do it in literally 15 minutes sometimes. So it wasn't long at all. But yeah, I always had a professional on the machines that were kind of hard to master. I'd always have a professional in with me. If anything were to go wrong, they could quickly grab the controls.
I'm sure a lot of people would like to imagine or would like to be a host on a TV show. What was something that was unexpected or that was more difficult than you thought or surprising? What's it like to be a host on a TV show?
The hard thing that I found for me, which I think was quite unique to the lifestyle I sort of had at the time, was that I was doing a full championship in the European Rally Championship at the same time. And they had a deadline for the filming. So they had like a couple of months really that they had to get it in. And it tied in as the busiest months of my racing as well. So that was really convenient. But it basically meant that every day when I wasn't racing, I would be filming. So I'd be flying straight back and going straight up to Scotland or wherever it would be to be filming. And I think the hardest part, which people don't really think about, is the amount of lines that you actually have to learn for it. So it's all scripted.
A lot of memorizing.
Yeah. So it's a lot of that, but it's not just kind of conversational stuff. Because I was explaining how machines would work, it would be quite detailed on like, this is how the cogs work. This is what powers this. And then because the racing side, you don't really just turn up and race. You're also in the rally situation, you're trying to watch onboard videos of the tracks from previous years to memorize the roads. So if you memorize it, you know where you're going and then you can go faster, obviously. So it's not, we don't do it as detailed as they do in Formula One because we'll be covering hundreds of kilometers over a weekend. So it's impossible really to learn it. But the more you can do, the better prepared you are. Well, I was looking to find a compromise basically between the two. And I actually got commissioned for a second and third series, but I had to say no to it just because I wanted to be a racer and that's what I went into the industry for. I just knew that I was kind of half doing both by the end of the series because I just couldn't, my brain couldn't hold any more info, to be honest with you. I had like random words from the TV show in my head when I was trying to remember where I'm going in the race. And then the other way around, I couldn't remember my words when I was on set. I was just exhausted, I think, and it was just sort of too much for me. Although I look back and it's, you never remember those bits. You remember like the amazing opportunities that you had. And I'll always, you know, I don't think I'll get opportunities to test those machines again in my life. So it is cool to have said to that I've done it.
Is there ever these instances where, oh, I just forgot my lines. Could you please show me what's on page 2, paragraph 3?
Yeah, every 10 minutes. Yeah, it was always a case of that. And to be honest, they don't, you know, because from their side, it's last minute as well. And what machines they can book. And from the production side, you don't really get the lines until 6 a.m. on the day. So you're not expected to be perfect. And I was lucky that my mum and my sister had been in the film industry and the TV industry for years. So my mum...
They coached you and helped you.
Well, she was a makeup artist. So for that show, she was actually employed as the makeup artist. So I put a special request in to have her on the show with me. So, you know, she doubled up as mummager and driver and all of the other things. So we had a little adventure together and it was amazing to have her because she would be able to tell when I was fading and when I needed a break and she knew me better than I knew myself. So she was really able to support me from that side.
That's part one of our talk with Katie. Join us again in 2 weeks where we take a deep dive in the technology behind this truly sustainable race series, what it's like for women to race against men on equal footing, and also learn if Katie was able to teach Prince William a thing or two about driving a rally car. As always, for more information about Siemens Digital Industries software, make sure to visit us at plm.automation.siemens.com. And until next time, I'm Ed Bernardin, and this has been the Future Car Podcast.